The following podcast is an Embassy Row production.
Oh, small ball back in the house. What a special episode we got planned for you guys today. We got the man of the hour, too sweet to be sour, Michael Davies, the man in Blazer himself from Men in Blazers, the unbelievably popular podcast. Welcome, Michael.
Welcome. Don't know. I think I own this podcast, Sharon.
You do. You do.
I need to welcome you.
The question is, what don't you own, Mike?
That is very, very true. That is very, very true. Well, I don't. I only own 50% of Men in Blazers. I think you should check your contract. I think I own 100% of this now.
No, it's not the white man. There he goes.
Honored. So I don't own it. We own this together. I'm honored to be in business with you. It's such a delight. Quite apart from being in business with each other, we're friends.
And so yes.
I love you, Sharad.
I say family. We family. Yes. Now, can you explain, for people who don't know what Men in Blazers are, what the show is all about? They must have been under a rock, but can you explain what the show is?
Well, I mean, look, I have to give you a little bit of the origin story to explain it. So when I first came to America, and I started watching, I've been here for 30 years, but I started watching sports on like NBC and CBS and the NFL and Major League Baseball. And I was always blown away that anybody who was talking about those sports who wasn't playing the sports on television was wearing a Blazer logo of either the league or the network they were on. And they didn't really have to know anything about what they were talking about. But as long as they had the Blazer with the logo on,
it seemed
that people would stop and listen to them and give them great reverence, however insane the things that they were saying were.
Now, did that all spark from ABC Sports? Because they're the first guys I remember being in Blazers with a logo on it from back
yellow,
in the day.
Right? They were golden Blazers or something. They were, Blazers. I mean, it's very odd thing. I mean, I think historically Blazers have a great, this is a whole separate podcast this week in Blazers. But there is a, Blazers have been connected to sport for a very long time, going back to the amateur era in the 19th century. And the sort of Men in Blazers were also like the guys that would be working at the, you know, the U.S. Football Association or whatever, working at league offices, would always wear Blazers. But it always, I found it remarkable that on TV, honestly, all anybody had to do was put on a Blazer, put on a logo, and suddenly people would listen to these dudes.
It's like putting on a doctor's coat. It's like I put on a doctor's coat.
Totally. We don't need to see their degree. We just needed to know that they had the coat on.
And where's the jacket?
Yeah. So we're my, when me and my friend Roger started, first of all, blogging about football, before I think it was even called a blog, soccer. And then we started doing something called a podcast on ESPN and then on Grantland. We called it Men in Blazers because the joke was, it was all about how that if we just put on Blazers and had a logo on it, people would start listening to us. And weirdly, the second we called it Men in Blazers and we put on Blazers and had a logo, lo and behold, people started listening to us. And we're sort of idiots. And we find football hilarious.
Right.
There's nothing more hilarious than American fans of soccer. They're the most self-loathing people in the world. And
why? Why is that, though?
I don't know. They're just hilarious. It's an alternative choice to love European, particularly European soccer. It's quite funny, like American soccer, too. But it's a very alternative choice. And they constantly have to defend themselves from people like you who are like, well, you're soccer. Why are you watching soccer? It's like not an American sport. Is soccer even big? Do people still watch soccer? Will soccer ever catch on in the US? And so we found this hilarious, which is why our catchphrase is soccer, America's sport of the future, as it has been since 1972. And we find situationally soccer in America, the people who love soccer in America, what's going on with European soccer. And we try and translate. In some ways, we're like, have you read Harry Potter, Sherrod? We're kind of like Mr. Weasley, who translates the Muggle world for wizards. We're translating the Muggle world of European soccer for Americans, and we use our own backstory to explain it. We've got a TV show on NBC Sports. We have a podcast. We do live shows. We have merchandise. We have brand deals. I mean, weirdly, it's become a business, and it's simply because we wear Blazers with a logo on it.
And you're selling it to Americans. Americans, we usually think that soccer is the sport we let our daughters play.
Yeah, and you've done it successfully. to multiple World Cups and Olympic titles,
Yeah, the women are killing it. But I'm a big fan. I'm actually a big fan of Premier League. You got me into it a lot in the last couple weeks,
good,
too,
like
because
it.
It's the only sport back, first of all. It's the only thing that we got. When did your addiction start? Because you have an addiction to this.
Well, I was born in 1966, Sherrod. That was a long time ago. I'm 54 years old.
And you look good.
is a thank you very much. 1966, a lot of work. 1966 is a significant year because England won the World Cup in 1966.
Okay.
It's the World Cup they've ever won. I was 3 months old, and I like to think that that was a formative experience when I was when it was baby Michael Davies sitting there. And when I was growing up, soccer was barely football, as we call it. It's association football, which is why it's called soccer from the SSOC and association.
Oh.
It's the code. So it's called soccer because it's association football. So when I was growing up, there was very little soccer on TV. You had to go and see it live. Mm-hmm. It was incredibly dangerous to go and see it live because there was so much violence.
Oh, the hooligans?
Yeah, lots of hooligans. My local teams... And I could literally hear the crowd noise from my home, from multiple grounds that were near me, Crystal Palace, Charlton, Millwall. And I wasn't allowed to go to those grounds because they were too dangerous. My dad wouldn't take me because he couldn't stand football. But my uncle lived in a sort of quite sort of snooty part of London called Chelsea, where there's a team, Chelsea Football Club, where the American great Christian Pulisic plays now.
Oh, yeah. Hershey, Pennsylvania.
Hershey, Pennsylvania. And my uncle would take me to see Chelsea starting when I was 5 years old in 1971. And Chelsea were amazing in 1971. So really? I got instantly hooked and became hooked on it forever and hooked on that team. And
then who's some of your favorite players from that team, that 71 team?
I mean, there's a player called Peter Osgood, who's one of my like heroes. You look at them now, they were uniformly white, uniformly either English or Scottish. Occasionally they had some diversity by having an Irishman who played. And you look at the game they play now and it was useless. But over time, Chelsea were one of the first teams that started to promote black footballers, started to bring in international players. And, you know, the league, English football became very cosmopolitan. It became a very global game. And I've been hooked forever. And I was a tennis player. That's how I came to the US to play tennis. But really, as far as fandom, it's always been football for me. Soccer first, ahead of everything else. I've had my flirtations with the NBA, certainly. Yeah. I like the NFL now a lot. I don't understand college sports. We can talk about that. and then sort of other sports I've watched. But really, soccer has been my true love. And especially the Premier League since it.
So how do you pick your teams over there? You just pick wherever you grew up, whatever the neighborhood team is?
Most people pick teams where they grow up. And I think there are some exceptions. Like for me, it was my uncle would go and take me in. So he would take me to see Chelsea. There are bizarrely Manchester United, a very famous team.
Yeah.
And the joke always about Manchester United is that, you know, most of their fans go home locally after the game by taking the train down to London, but Manchester United has loads of fans in London. It's the most popular team in London in some ways. And sometimes it's passed down family. Sometimes it's sectarian. Some teams have either Catholic. If you're Catholic, you support this team. If you're Protestant, you support this team. Yeah, there are certain teams that are known to, like, you know, have had more Jewish ownership or Jewish players. And so Tottenham Hotspur, if you're Jewish, you naturally have a big Jewish fan base. The location of London where they are, but also because of their chairman and their history. And so it's a there are lots of things that go into it, just like choosing an American sports team.
Yeah, but we never pick a team over religion. We're never like, oh, I like the Colts because they're Catholic.
that's true. Although I would love to like figure out, I'm sure that somewhere in your mailbox somebody's going to say, yes, here is a team.
Well, Notre Dame, if you go college, maybe like Notre Dame.
That's true. Lots of Roman Catholics go for Notre Dame, having no affiliation whatsoever with the school. That's very true.
Now, how violent did the games get? Like when you were a kid, like when you were a teenager, you go to the games, was it super violent? Like in a stands?
Okay, there are two ways to go and process this. You're already asking about like fan violence. The fan violence... And there are still some isolated incidents today around certain teams, but on the whole, it's calmed down a lot.
Right.
The people were barely watching the game going on the field. The hardcore ultras were really just there to fight with each other. There are some tremendous books written about it. Bill Buford wrote a book you would love called Among the Thugs.
Yeah.
I have to send that to you. Among the Thugs is probably the best book that documents it. It's an American journalist, American writer, who documents his... couple of years living within the hardcore, you know, violent fan groups. And he became so, you know, sort of in it that he actually committed acts of violence within it as well. It's a brilliant book.
Wow.
And it was massive. You were terrified for life. But by the way, that wasn't that different than what life was like living in England in the 1970s and 80s anyway. It was quite a violent society. You were often beaten up, you know, for, you know, wearing the wrong outfit or listening to the wrong music in the wrong area. You know, Britain is very tribal. in that way. You know,
was your school like that when you went to like high school? Or?
Yeah, my high school was 850 boys between the ages of 11 and 18 who pretty much were motivated to beat the crap out of each other on a daily basis.
Was knife fights a big thing? It seemed like you had a bunch of stabbers over there.
Now, knife fighting's a big thing. I'm from the London Borough of Greenwich, number one in Britain for knife violence.
represent.
There's a lot of knife crime in London now. Growing up, there wasn't a lot of knife crime. I remember being at one point seeing a fight at a bus stop where somebody pulled a knife, and then he unfortunately pulled a knife on the one guy in our school who really knew kung fu, and like everybody claims to know kung fu, and then before a fight, and then you realize when the fight starts, either they know no kung fu or kung fu is going to be useless. But this is one fight I've spoken about a lot with my friend Steve Parrish, who I grew up with, who now owns Crystal Palace Football Club, and we just both remember this kid, and he would say before a fight, you know, I really know kung fu, and the other guy would look at him like, oh yeah, okay, here we go, and then the guy was awesome at kung fu. He was like Bruce Lee, and he literally flicked the knife out of his hand with his foot with like sort of a roundhouse kick, and then destroyed them. So yeah, there were a few knives.
Is stabbing like in England what shooting is here? Is that
yes,
for the knife?
There are a few guns now in Lewisham and Greenwich, but on the whole, it's still knife fighting. When I was at school, the big move was to, like, you know, the way that school fights and brawl fights travel. So you start in the upper playground, you then end up in the lower playground. And then the whole move was to end up in the long jump pit and to get to the sand, because you could end the fight by getting the sand in the eye of your opponent. It's unfortunately why I still don't see very well out of my left eye. But that was the move.
Is that why your parents got you involved in tennis, to give you away from that?
Yeah, they want to give me a country club sport, you know? Yeah. Pretty much, I mean, that was the ticket that got me out of South London, is being able to hit a tennis ball.
And how much did you love it? Did you love it?
Yeah, I simply love hitting a tennis ball. I actually probably, you know, there are a few reasons I didn't end up making as a tennis player. And it took me around the world. I played juniors all around the world.
And what age? What age was this?
I really started when I was very young, but I won nationals when I was 11, unexpectedly. And so then my life changed at that point. And so I was traveling competitively and playing everywhere. But I wasn't I wasn't technically gifted as a tennis player.
Right.
I had a lot of endurance and long legs, so I could cover the court pretty well. But despite being tall, I was never a serve and volleyer. I was a counter puncher as a tennis player. And I was sort of competitive in spirit, but really what I loved more than anything else is I just loved hitting tennis balls. So my desire to be in long rallies was because I just loved hitting a ball. I grew up hitting a ball against a wall. I could play tennis for the rest of my life, which I really intend to, I'm still playing now, but I will never hit as many balls on a tennis court as I hit against a wall growing up in like a courtyard of like where people park their cars. There was a one end, I would just hit against the wall the whole time. I love hitting a tennis ball.
That's kind of like me and masturbation. I can never have sex with a woman as much as I against the wall.
Well, also, you know yourself. You know what you like, Sherrod. You're probably good to yourself.
Got a word I'm overhand. So, I mean, ain't there a lot of pressure on an 11-year-old kid to be, you know, shipped around the world playing tennis? Did you have fun? Was it too much pressure? Or you?
Number one, I had no pressure because my parents had zero interest. So I came from a family where, and that was a great thing. My parents were like not really, they were into their own stuff. I remember when I won nationals, my dad literally drove me. My dad came down to pick me up and we were rain delayed. So the match didn't start in time. And my dad stood at the back of the court when he arrived, pointing at his watch because we were late. And I went to three sets. I drove home in silence in the back of the car with my trophy in disgrace. That made my dad wait. So I wasn't from a family where like there was this expectation of parents. For me, you know, getting out of London in the late 70s, early 80s, I lived in France for a few months, went to school out there.
How was that? Did they tease you because you was English?
Yeah, but I didn't understand what they were saying. I had a French girlfriend who was so mean to me, but she was just French. It's just like,
yeah, you could have just said she's a French girl.
It was just a French girl, but it was like nice I got out of the house. So yeah, I got teased a lot. But it was like, I was in France. I was like, you know, drinking good coffee. I was like eating decent food. Like I didn't care about any of this. And then I came to America, which was just like mind blown.
And where did they send you in America? You went to Florida?
Yeah, I went to Florida. I played the Orange Bowl. And then I went to boarding school in Pennsylvania. I went, so in 1985, January 1985, I wanted to go and play college tennis in America. And I came to do a PG year at an American boarding school, a postgraduate year. And there are all these schools in the Mid-Atlantic where you, where they sort of bring in athletes to go and be like great. And I also got a scholarship from this organization that brings English people to America to go and play sports in American schools.
Okay.
So I arrived at this school. Sherrod, the first person I met in this school was a Puerto Rican basketball PG. So a basketball player from Puerto Rico.
Yeah.
Ran out of the dorm singing Mick Jagger at the top of his lungs to me because I was the only English person he'd ever met and he was obsessed with Mick Jagger. That person, no shit, was Benicio
what?
Del Toro.
What?
Was the first person I met.
Wait a minute.
You know, my first friend I made in America was Benicio Del Toro, who was a Benicio Del Turnover, who was a PG basketball player at the boarding school that I was sent to in America.
In Pennsylvania?
In the middle of rural Pennsylvania, in the middle of nowhere Pennsylvania.
That's so random. How old was he at the time?
He was like 18, 19, same age as me.
Wow.
So that was the first person I met. And they put me because I was an international student. And the reason that he ran out is that I was put into the dorm with all the other international students and black kids. And so it was just like
there
me. And so I literally moved into this incredibly diverse world, which I never, I mean, I come from a very diverse part of London, but I was, my introduction to America in 1985 was this really rich world. I got into go-go music and like,
oh yes,
with my friends, Greg Jones and Eric Dandridge. I sort of went to like downtown New York with my friends from New York City. I like listened to like early hip hop. Like I had this like introduction to America that was very unconventional because of this weird world.
What school is this? What school?
It's called the Mercersburg Academy. It's a really, really good boarding school that just had a lot of international students and kids of diplomats. So a lot of my friends, their parents were diplomats and they were sent to this school. You know?
It's a rich kid school. It's rich kids. Benicio Del Toro family had that kind of money?
No, I think he was a scholarship kid. So if you're good at sport, you got in for free. You
know? Right.
So I got in. So it was a, so, but, you know, it's weirdly like a lot of these schools can end up, you know, manufacturing diversity, right? By using scholarships and using, you know, their endowment to sort of make it happen.
And how different was it, like a culture shock when you first got here?
Oh, so much culture shock. Number one, everyone said hello.
Yeah.
Literally, I would walk down the street and people would say, how you doing? And I'd say, oh, terribly pleased to meet you. My name is Michael Davis. I'm actually doing quite well today. Thanks for asking. And they would be like, what are you doing? I didn't come from a place.
It's Michael Caine.
Yeah, I didn't come from a place where people said, how you doing? I came from a place where people would walk past you and like just want to kick your teeth in. Like that, if you hadn't been introduced to someone, they wanted to kill you. And yeah. So it was a very different than growing up in South London. So
and how many years you were there? How many?
I was there for a year and it was the greatest year of my life. And then I decided not to go and play college tennis. I wasn't going to get into a school that was academically good enough and go and play decent tennis there. And I also realized at that point I wasn't good enough at tennis. I think Boris Becker won Wimbledon that summer and he was younger than me. I was like, who are you kidding? You're never going to be a tennis player.
So what was your style like? What, if you're going to compare your style to somebody.
Steffi Graf.
Why? Yeah, somebody from stabbing in the back?
But so I'm comparing myself to a female tennis player with great respect and love.
She got stabbed in the back too, right?
No, that was...
Oh, that's Monica Seles.
Oh, no, Monica Seles, yeah.
Monica Seles.
You know, Steffi Graf was like sort of, you know, tall and lean. She had a huge forehand. She used her backhand to just set up her forehand. And she looks really good, very elegant tennis court. I never dated Andrea Gassi. Don't have any children with her. but that was definitely my style. But no, it was a culture shock. It was a culture shock for every reason, partly because of how friendly people were, partly because everybody thought I was awesome just because I was British. It was a time when, you know, now they're like, you can throw a stone in New York City, you hit 100 Englishmen. Like back then, it was pretty unique to be British and people loved it. It was like, oh my God, I love your accent. Oh my God.
They call you James Bond. I know you got a lot of James Bond.
Yeah. And I had all this music that people wanted to listen to. Like I had Sade's first album that people were really into and I was really into music. So I had stuff to like exchange and share. It's when young British people and young American people listened to very different music. They had very different influences and it was like, that was awesome.
Did you get laid in the States when you was at this boarding school?
Yep.
Yeah. Was it all boys school or it was mixed?
No, that was mixed. It was the first time I'd ever been to a school with girls, which was like remarkable. And yeah, and girls who wanted to have sex, which is
nice. Which is nice. We were away from home too.
No, it's very sick. And there was like, yeah. And like, and I've said this to a few people before. I've never said it publicly on a podcast, but blowjobs did not exist in Britain in the early 1980s. They hadn't come over yet. There was apparently one, I remember legend of one girl named Debbie in North London who might have given a blowjob once, but it had never happened. It was a particularly American invention.
And really? No.
It was like COVID. In the mid-1980s, blowjobs were everywhere in America. Everywhere. Like everywhere you turned. Everywhere.
You couldn't help but to get one.
Oh, it was like, there was no choice. I didn't know that there was a choice.
And then you have to tell your friends back home, like, guess what? You will never believe it.
Well, no, I didn't even bother because no one would have believed it.
Really?
So it was a legend. It was literally, I could have said the earth is flat, or like I found Atlantis or Bigfoot, and it would have
been. I would think that it started there. I would think that it came over with the pilgrims. No?
I don't think so. I don't think so. But
well,
yeah,
what do you think about the now
the mid-80s?
The Premier League, they I respect this. At the beginning of all the games now, everybody's taking a knee for Black Lives Matter.
Yeah.
What do you think about that?
Of course, I think it's awesome. What I do find a little odd about it is that it's not an act of defiance, right? So when Colin started taking the knee in the NFL during the national anthem, and some of his teammates started joining in, and people in other teams.
Yeah.
Some of his other fellow union members started doing it. It was an act of defiance,
right?
While other people weren't doing it. At the point that everybody does it, including the referees and the line judges and the executives on the sideline and the team doctors and everybody else, it is a little less to me. I mean, I understand it's symbolic. It's a gesture of unity, which is superb. But some of the edge and teeth have gone out of it. And I'm fascinated to see what happens when the NFL comes back, when the NBA comes back. What happens when they play the national anthem? Because then it's going to be an act of defiance again. The other thing I think about it is taking a knee in England is an act of deference to royalty. So it's something that people take the knee when they
kneel. Oh, so they don't look bad. Yeah, I never thought about that.
I worry that the taking of a knee in Britain has a slightly different symbolic meaning than it does to take a knee during a national anthem is a really big gesture. But it's, you know, look, with the gestures are important and statements of unity are important.
Yeah.
I actually think that we're, you know, in sports, it's amazing to like think of, if you go back now and read the coverage on Colin Kaepernick when this started happening, it's pretty amazing to read through contemporary eyes.
Yeah, because he was right the whole time. And the right, we knew it. We knew it wasn't against the flag. It was just, he was bringing attention to the violence, police violence against Black youth, unarmed youth. And we all knew that, but people try to skew it and make it something else, change it to something. And it's like, that's not it. And then it all came crashing down on all of us.
Yeah, yeah. And he did it in the most peaceful and actually respectful manner. That's what is so, you know.
But you gotta understand, in America, whenever a Black man speak up for his rights, if they already see it as non-peaceful. Martin Luther King was seen as a terrorist.
Yeah.
Even Nelson Mandela, our government said Nelson Mandela was, they had him marked as a terrorist through the whole 70s and 80s.
Yeah.
Nelson Mandela.
Yeah.
So, but you know.
It's not easy being Neil deGrasse Tyson.
That's right. You motherfuckers need science. I mean, it's brutal. So do you think the NFL, these players are still going to kneel at the national anthem when they play at this, when they come back?
I think, honestly, I think that I actually think the NBA is slightly different because the NBA are so, they're so in touch with their players. You know, they really talk to their players all the time.
Yeah.
But I think all of the other leagues are desperately trying to figure out ways that they can appease everybody.
Yeah.
And so they're going to pull some kind of, like, there will be playing of some second national anthem where it can happen, or there'll be a pre moment for people to like protest anything they feel able to.
Like
protest.
A smoking section.
And then we'll play the national anthem, or they'll just stop playing the national anthem in order to avoid it. I don't.
Leia didn't always do that either. That came. That was something that started later.
Yeah, you and I spoke about that. It started in like the 1940s or something. And and in domestic sports in the Premier League, they don't play any kind of national anthem. You know, they only play it in international games when, you know, England play, you know, France. They'll play both countries' national anthems before they start. They don't play the national anthem before every club game, before Chelsea play Arsenal. Like, it doesn't exist. I think that's actually also a peculiarly American tradition.
Okay. And what do you feel about the NBA trying to come back in Florida, the fucking, the peak of...
In the bubble. In the bubble. It's entertainment. I can't believe it's not a reality show. It would be so good.
I think they don't want to shoot the behind-the-scenes stuff because we'll see how many blunders they do and people get affected.
Yeah. I mean, I think that it's one of these things that was like, on paper, it seemed like a really good idea. But yeah. This is something I struggle to articulate, but I'm going to try and articulate to you, is that sports have been perfected. The way that we've built our professional sports and the way we've built the audience experience and the television experience has been developed over decades and decades and decades, and actually in some cases more than 100 years.
Yeah.
And the calendar and the way we do it. And so for some guy to suddenly sit, or some group to suddenly sit and say, oh, you know what, we're going to go and play the entire end of the season at this point with this many teams, and then we'll figure it out and we'll just do it down there. What has taken years and years and years and decades and decades and decades to perfect, they're now trying to like put on paper and do it, not realizing what's going to happen. So actually, I think the Premier League has had a better approach, is they changed as little as they possibly had to, but they changed everything they had to. But the teams are playing on the schedule they were going to play against the teams they were going to play. On the schedule in order. They're playing in order the teams they were going to play, and they're playing out the season at their home grounds with no fans. Of course, it's a smaller country. There's less travel involved.
Right.
Is
that possible for the NBA? You think the NBA can even, like, can you even consider, like, how do you tell a player from New York when things are dropping that he got a game in, you know, in Dallas?
Well, number one, these teams all have their own jets, number one. Right. So it's not like they're all like figuring out to squeeze into the middle seat.
They're not on JetBlue with me?
They're not on JetBlue with any of us. So they have their own jets. And they may have decided, you know what, we're going to change the schedule a little bit. And so we're going to go and have a team go and play on the road for a little bit longer. Instead of a 5-game road trip, we'll go and extend it out. Or they might have had to decide, but instead of, what they did is they changed everything.
Yeah.
Rather than changing as little as possible. And I think, and by the way, I don't think the Premier League has been perfect. I hate the artificial crowd noise that they put in. I cannot.
I actually like it. You know what? I kind of like it. I like that tone of.
I know, but you've never watched soccer in your life. And so you don't know what it was like before. Like, so it's like, whoa, this is nice. I like the noise. It's like you're, it's not a, believe me, I take all of your opinions seriously, sure.
I thought it was cool. I'll say some games don't play it at all. They don't have it. But some games have
it. It doesn't work that day. They try to make it work on every game, but they don't have it on every game. So but I do think that changing as little as possible is probably a smarter way to go.
Yeah. I think they got NBA got their hands to us.
The bubble is so different. It's so different, and it's such a different experience. But you know what?
Are they confirmed that they're doing it? Are they already sending teams down there? Are they practicing? I don't know.
Yeah, they're all in the bubble.
They're all there now. I
don't know if practices started or they're just positive.
He ordered food.
Yeah, he crossed the line of the bubble. He crossed the line. He can't get Postmates or something to take delivery. And so, it's
if a Postmates is it worth doing?
Yeah. I don't know. These people are very hungry. They want good food. They're in hotel rooms. These are young men all alone. Yeah. Away. It's like during every World Cup when they send all these foreign players from around the world and they go to a country and they live in a compound to go and play the World Cup. Every year, these guys get neck tattoos and like stupid haircuts because they have so much time left to themselves in their room. They just get bored, you know.
It's like Olympic Village, right? It's like when you go to the Olympics, everybody comes away with tattoos and pregnancies.
Yeah, a lot. But I don't know that there's, you know, that there aren't a lot of pregnancies. There aren't a lot of options to go out. I think they closed Pleasure Island. I don't think there's a lot that they can go and get.
So what do you think? Baseball going to try at all this year?
I'm not really up to speed on that. I have watched a little bit of the Taiwanese baseball, which I think is great. I don't know what baseball is going to try and do. Baseball has a real problem because of the number of games. They have this anyway. I mean, all that COVID has done is accelerated all the problems that already existed, right? And so baseball was already struggling because of the inventory. It had like how much inventory, so many games, supported by, you know, broadcast and linear cable. So they needed a lot of advertising, but there's advertising is gradually leaving television. And so there's just like too much inventory. And that's made it really difficult for them during COVID too.
Jesus Christ. Do you think it's a smart idea just for American sports to say, no 2020 games, we're just going to wait to the 2021 to start an event?
Look, I think it might be easier, instead of trying to revolutionize the calendar, I think it may be easier just to take a halt and try and start everything again when the calendar works out. But I think, unfortunately, there is so much money that gets lost in that. And quite apart from players losing salary, owners losing money, and it's also broadcast networks go out of business, advertisers who support these things. I mean, it's just a mess. It's a giant mess.
The last time the NHL didn't play because of the COVID, because of a flu, was in 1919. They canceled the Stanley Cup game because not only the coach, I think one of the coaches died, one of the players died, and the whole team was sick. Only three players on both teams weren't sick.
Yeah.
I mean, is it worth putting the team in that position again in fucking 2020?
No, but I think you're going to go to a lot of professional athletes and a lot of people whose livelihoods depend on this stuff and say, hey, look, by canceling sport, your contract is null and void. And suddenly it's suddenly worth playing, you know?
Do you think players should be fined if they choose not, if these leagues do choose to come back early, or should they be fined by the league for not coming back?
Well, I don't know, but fined by the league, but I think that some of these teams and some of these leagues are pretty close to, you know, I'm not saying this is going to happen to the NBA, the NHL, or the NFL, but there is going to end up being a correction in terms of player salaries. It will happen. Right. You know, player salaries have accelerated faster than all the other costs related in the game, which is, by the way, has been good. These people are the sport. They deserve to be paid. But there will be a correction. If not immediately, there will be a correction over time in terms of how much players are played. And so this is sort of for everybody. It's sort of why instinctively, without sort of much evidence, but instinctively, I sort of feel like the NBA is in more communication with its players than any other league. And so that everybody seems to be like more like in it together.
I think because the NBA have more ex-players who are actually in the front office now than any other league.
Bingo. And yeah, owners. Yeah. Which is a massive thing.
And the NFL ain't got anything close to that. NFL is ran just like corporations ran anywhere else. They ain't bringing in nobody. They don't even look for the ex-players to come in. The people who actually know the game know the players and fucking can liaisons between them. They don't bring them in. How much money is Vegas losing in all this?
Oh, Vegas is losing a ridiculous amount. I'm not really going to shed a tear for Vegas, though, because I think they figure out a way to get it all back. But Vegas is losing a lot of money. Everybody's losing money, Sherrod. Everybody.
So did they So first of all, FanDuel, they seem like they're doing well.
Yeah, no, sorry. When I say everybody loses money, there's a lot of digital businesses that are not losing money. I wonder if people are gambling more. They must be gambling more. FanDuel, DraftKings, Fantasy Sport.
Yeah, I want to talk about Fantasy
Sport. They're probably not doing as well because they don't have baseball. They don't have, like, major American sports. But a lot of people are turned on to the Premier League. Like, you know, we have mutual friends who are now FanDuel every single day, who've never even watched a soccer match before, and they're obsessed with it.
We're joined now by Kate Herman. She's the model and comedian, taking all the jobs. And not only that, she's a big fan of Premier League and a bigger fan of FanDuel. Kate?
Hey.
Let's be really clear about this. I did not get Kate addicted to the Premier League. I basically, it's kind of like, what do they say, that like a nacho chip is just a vehicle for dip. Guacamole, is that the Premier League is merely a vehicle for Kate to fantasy gamble. That is exactly. She has little interest in the actual sport whatsoever, but it's filling a massive hole in her life.
Which is
gambling on sports.
But if you see her watching the game, she's already in. She knows all the players. She's even got me more addicted to it because just the game. I think the gambling aspect of all games brings more eyes on the sport. Just like NFL, a lot of people say fantasy football was ruining the NFL, but a lot of people say it helped the NFL make even more money because it's getting more people involved in it. Do you see that?
My whole thing with it is that I learn the game so much quicker and better when I know every single player because I'm putting money on the line. And it's, you know, you're making these puzzles out of these players. So you have to learn not just like who on your team is good. You have to know the entire league of wherever you're playing.
I would vouch for that in that in all of my years in America of introducing American friends of mine to the Premier League and to soccer, Kate has actually grasped the structure of the league, individual players, playing systems, all these things quicker than anybody I've ever known. Yeah. And it must be because you are
bored.
It's a combination of you are bored out of your mind. You miss gambling on American sports. You love gambling.
Yeah.
Yes.
And competing.
He's good at it.
And you can drink during the daytime, which we
actually honestly, yeah. If you get up early enough, you can start at 7:30.
That's what we constantly encourage Americans to watch Premier League because you can just openly drink beer for breakfast.
Well, that's like when the World Cup was going on last time I was in LA and we would meet at a bar at like 6:30 in the morning and get Irish coffees and bring laptops and watch the games.
I think we definitely learn the game.
Combination of the show, we're like a morning zoo thing on the radio. We should launch. Forget about small ball, Sherrod. We should launch this as a podcast with the three of us talking about
that was fast. God damn it!
Life and comedy and everything we think. I love this team.
Yeah, it's a good team, right?
Who did this? I would put this as a lineup for sure.
Yes,
I would stack this one.
Kate, who did you bet on today on any of these games? There's a lot of games today.
So, a lot of games. Today was tricky. It's a hard slate because it has some of the top scorers in the league spread over four different games. Who's going to make the goals? I pretty much did very well so far. I mean, I hesitate to talk about it because there's still another game coming up. But figuring out who's going to get the goals is like one thing. And then you have to be so strategic with the defense in here. And on one of my lineups, Patricio broke my heart in the sixth minute of overtime.
Yeah.
When, you know, spoiler alert, but Chris Wood knocked one in the very last second. Totally threw me off.
Some of these things got like 4,000, 5,000 people betting on this game, and she'll come in like 17th.
Well, because you want to figure out not only who's going to score the goal, but who's going to score the goal that nobody else has. And then the rest is just math and figuring out value and how, like I use FanDuel. So I know FanDuel scores things a certain way. So who can I get that maybe is like a $6 player that's going to score at least 20 points and maybe not score a goal, but like nobody else will have on there.
It's also slightly difficult to predict this season, I think, even though Kate, you're doing, I just kind of, you send me like how you've done every day and I'm like blown away by like how well you're doing. I can't do that well. These teams, like there's a huge game going on like now, Arsenal-Liverpool. Mm-hmm. It's like Liverpool have already won the league. What do they actually have to play for?
Right.
The players all have contracts for next year. Arsenal are sort of like, somewhat in it. I guess those players are still sort of playing for honor. They sort of seem to play better when they've got no pressure on them. But it's tough to call a lot of these games.
Well, it's interesting too, because I'm coming in at the end of a season, but then there was that break. And so it's interesting coming in and learning things at the end of the season, because A, now you have like substitutions. So you can't totally rely on people playing a full 90 because depending on what team they are and what they're playing for, like you said,
that bugs me. You know, the person you pick and be taken out the game, and then now you can't, like, in the middle of the game.
I think it's just because it's the end of the season, though, because they're resting, you know what I mean? Like, they're resting certain players. But that's also, like, a time for... But it's also a good time for major upsets, like the Leicester game last Saturday.
Oh, Leicester? Okay, interesting. Leicester.
Because that was like amazing. Like everybody was
Leicester.
Like, they're
going
to win.
It's Leicester.
Leicester. You know what? I'm not
British. They spell it weird over there.
You know, Wolfenhavenford. Like, a lot of his names. Anyway, I'm just used to, like, you know, Chicago. But yeah, no, but that was like such an interesting one because I skewed it a little, assuming that they wouldn't blow them out, but then it was such an upset and such a
oh, that game, that game was remarkable. That Bournemouth game was just remarkable. It was insane.
Yeah.
It
was
Did you see the hat trick that Sterling got the other day?
A Raz trick. Trademark pending. It was a Raz trick. A Raz trick.
But see, that was one of those times where I literally was like, do I play Jesus or Sterling? And for no good reason other than I basically coin tossed it to Sherrod, who said Sterling. You know what I mean? Like,
I had
that
a good
was
feeling
a
about
big,
him. I know how to pick him. Yeah.
You got to go with gut, always.
Did you have Mikel Antonio when he scored, or as I call him, Mikel Antonio? Did you have him when he played, when he scored four for West Ham the other day?
I didn't, because that was one of those early start games, and I didn't trust myself to wake up early enough to check the lineup.
I mean, four goals is how many points? That's an insane number.
That's unbelievable.
Oh, it's almost 100.
That's crazy.
So what's
it should be close to 100.
Liverpool, nobody can catch Liverpool, right? Is that the...
No, they're the champions, but there's now Champions League. It's right. going to happen soon, which is when the biggest teams across Europe will play each other. And that's about...
Chelsea's in there, right?
That's what?
Is Chelsea playing?
Chelsea's in it, but they've already played before COVID. They lost the first leg against Bayern Munich 3-0, so they're not going to go through
3-0.
But Manchester City in it. Manchester City may well win the Champions League this year. They may well be the best team in the Champions League.
And why do you say that?
Yeah.
Why? Why do you...
Well, because Manchester City are awesome.
They're incredible.
Got beaten. Somehow Liverpool just took them apart in the Premier League this year. But you actually look at the individual players on Manchester City and the players on the bench, and they're incredible.
Yeah, they got a crew, man. They got a straight crew.
And now every time I check Twitter, I feel like a new NBA, like Westbrook just got COVID. You know, I'm so nervous that none of these American sports are actually going to come back. Thank God.
Again before the end of August, like it's going to come for the next season. It's like there's a great thing about if you
it's
can
perfect. Get in
gambling on soccer, it basically goes on all year round.
Yeah,
it's
out of all the great. American sports, the only one that I'm counting on coming back is NHL because they're playing their games in Canada.
Maybe.
And because after games, you know, the smell back. Nobody's trying to hook up with the smelly hockey player as much as the.
They're wearing a lot of protective gear, like all of their
exactly. It's not really a contact sport when there's zero chance of skin touching.
Yeah. So there's definitely that.
Do you think we all can survive? How long can we survive without having this having sports back? Because it's really the glue to hold society together. I mean, I'm sure domestic violence is up.
Look, I'm amazed that sport is a huge thing for me. Like, I watch enormous amounts of sport on television. I follow it in the media, like, and I'm sort of into everything.
Yeah.
Watch more soccer and golf and tennis than anything else, but like, I watch everything. I'm amazed how well I did and most of my friends did with not having sport to watch on a daily, weekly basis. And then, you know, we filled it. It's why The Last Dance did incredibly well on TV. Like, we all watched documentaries. Mm-hmm. Like, we did. But I think it then got to a certain point, sort of at the three-month mark, where people were like, okay, not funny anymore. We sort of need it again.
Because, man, we only got three things to talk about. Sports, weather, and routes to work.
Well, that's why I started betting on the weather. I was like, I'll bet you $10 it rains in it.
Oh,
like,
my God.
I don't know.
That's an app that you should start. A okay? That's such a good idea.
That's what I'm here for. Okay. Idea City.
That honestly could be your billion-dollar idea, is nice. gambling on the weather app. But everyone's
talking to it.
My
daughter's a high school tennis player. My little boy George, he's really into everything. He's weirdly, he I don't think he's going to be a professional soccer player, but he could be a professional soccer freestyler. He just does all the freestyling, like he juggles, he does little tricks, he does all that kind of stuff. That's bigger now for the TikTok generation. Freestyle is bigger than actual playing a game.
Meanwhile, in China, they're running drills.
Yeah, no, they're running real drills, and like they're all in academies and doing it. Meanwhile, our kids are like just doing little tricks.
But you make this in four screens.
Yeah, no, it's so true.
We're doomed. Well, this has been a great episode, but now this is the end of the show, and we usually do a segment called Cutting Down the Nets. Okay. It's something in your life, Mike, that you would cut down the nets to, like you're celebrating a championship. It could be sports-related or not.
Oh, something great that has happened that I would cut down the nets?
Yes. You got so many things, you son of a bitch.
Oh, my God. There have been some things in my life, greatest moments of my life. Do you know what? I'm actually going to go... I'm gonna give a few contenders that immediately came to mind. Kate has been a very, very important person in my life. And Kate is great friends with my partner, Christine, and certainly meeting Christine. That's a cut down the nets moment. You know Christine too, Sharon.
Yes, yes.
Yes.
So that's definitely
I'll get champagne out for that.
The other day, somebody sent me a video of the first time that Millionaire won an Emmy. And that was an incredible moment, not because it was so great. I didn't have that moment of like, oh my God, winning an Emmy is the greatest thing in my life. But I was being shit-talked by Bob Barker in the moment before they announced who the winner was.
It's really?
Bob Barker was sitting behind me, kicking my seat, saying, when they're saying the nominees are, and Bob Barker was literally sitting behind me, kicking my seat, saying, you're not going to win, you're not going to win, you're not going to win. And then they called out my name and we won. And that was like a great moment, really just because I was getting shit talked by Bob Barker and I knew
that's hilarious.
I was going to have that forever. But definitely my moment.
An asshole, just like he was in Happy Madison.
Yeah. But my moment where it actually felt like a movie, going back to the beginning of this podcast and going to this amazing school in Pennsylvania, and meeting Benicio del Toro and having this like amazing sort of world of the international and minority students who are my group of friends. They have this amazing competition at the school. It's like something out of a John Hughes movie called Irving Marshall Week, where the whole school is divided into two societies, Irving and Marshall. And we compete against each other at everything. But they have this incredibly sort of loaded scoring system, a little bit like the FedEx Cup in golf, where it doesn't really matter what you do all season, it's just what you do in the final weeks.
Right.
And it all comes down to this final night competition called declamation, which is used to be a debate competition, but now it had become like a dramatic monologue competition.
Right.
And I was declaiming for Irving for my society. And as I walked up to do this, like it was the hackiest thing of all time, Kate. I took a social nets in play, and I took two parts that didn't even occur in the same place. And because I could do a half decent Russian accent, sure, I did both the father and the son talking to each other.
Yeah.
And I did it like with the father looking down and the son looking up, and this like, you know, Russian accent that I could do at that age. And I did this whole thing, and I did this monologue. And at the end, when it finished, I had sort of two moments like frozen. Is one, Benicio del Toro, who was in my dramatic society, led the applause from the front row when I finished. They're like, yes! Like in this sort of...
That's
like,
insane.
Cheering. It was Benicio. I remember that when he became a huge star later. And later that night, Benicio was one of the guys with all of my friends who at the dance afterwards, when they announced the winner at the school dance, like total John Hughes movie, I was lifted. The only time in my life I've been lifted on the shoulders of like everybody and paraded around because I just won the competition for Irving. And that I literally that moment of like a shoulder lift moment, which is one of the great things. That's one of the great moments, like to have a shoulder lift moment.
I agree.
Very few people who haven't won a national championship have ever had a shoulder lift moment. I had a shoulder lift moment. And by the way, it was my first year in America. I thought, hey, everyone in America gets one of these moments. This is why it's the greatest country in the world.
The rite of passage, one man in America.
That's
all. That is an amazing story. That's great.
Just trying to deliver for your podcast. Just trying to deliver for small ball.
Yeah, yeah. Keep it up, yo. End of the bargain. Okay. That was great. Everybody listening out there, make sure you check out Small Ball. Check Small Ball out on Apple Music and Spotify. You had fun?
That was great. Thank you so much, guys.
Thanks for coming on.